it was a wonderful thing for me to be able to shoot the reality, because they looked at all the reference, and the art department had done an incredible job. And Ruth had found things like when they hoisted the gadget and the tower, they put mattresses underneath it in case it fell. And I was like, well, we got to put that in the film. I mean, it's so representative of how insane the whole proposition was.
Hello, and welcome back to The Director's Cut, brought to you by the Directors Guild of America. In honor of the 76th Annual DGA Awards, we're bringing back our annual series of episodes devoted to our popular Meet the Nominees Theatrical Feature Film Symposium. The event is a roundtable discussion with the directors nominated for the Guild's Award for Outstanding Directorial Achievement in Theatrical Feature Film. This year's nominees included Greta Gerwig, the director of Barbie, Yorgos Lanthimos, the director of Poor Things, Christopher Nolan, the director of Oppenheimer, Alexander Payne, the director of The Holdovers, and Martin Scorsese, the director of Killers of the Flower Moon. These talented directors gathered on stage at the Guild's Los Angeles Theater on February 10th to discuss the craft of directing and the making of their films with moderator Jeremy Kagan. So please enjoy part one of our Meet the Nominees Theatrical Feature Film special.
We are so fortunate to have these amazingly talented directors all be with us today. Right here there, Marty. This morning I was looking at some images by William Blake, and he said that imagination is not a state, it is the essence of human existence itself. And you five are inspiring sculptors of imagination. And to pick a line from your movies, all of you show us and see worlds beyond what we really live in. And we thank you for your creativity. It's just amazing. And now to get serious into process, because you know this is an audience of directors and directorial teams, so we want to know how you do it. So let's start with a really important question. What shoes do you wear when you're on set? This actually relates stronger to your movie, because it's really in your movie. And where do you stand and where do you sit when you're on your sets? Chris, let's start with you. What shoes do you wear?
I mostly Echo shoes, but I've recently discovered Blundstones that are the ubiquitous crew boot, and they're very good. So I think I'll be switching to the Blundstones. I like to be right by the camera, watching the performance from the camera. So we don't have a video village or anything, and I have a little UHF monitor that I hang around my neck so I could just check framings or use the camera top monitor. But I just try and watch to eye. That's my spot.
And let's be fair here, let's introduce you all. This is Christopher Nolan for Oppenheimer.
I am Christopher Nolan, yes.
And next to him is Yorgos Lanthimos for Poor Things. And Alexander Payne for Holdovers. And Greta Gerwig for Barbie. And Martin Scorsese for Killers of the Flower Moon. You know, in a way, your films are so wonderful, it's like, why talk about them? Let's just keep seeing them. But let's talk a little bit more about them. Yorgos, what do you use
Damn
for
it,
shoes?
I thought we're
what do you use for shoes, and where do you stand or where do you sit?
I wear Hoka's because I have a broken sesamoid, if you know what that is. So I can't wear anything else. Only when it's a nice event like this, I wear my nice shoes. I also like only have a small monitor, and I try to be close to the camera and close to the actors, but I also try and make myself small as much as it is possible and kind of be out of the way, but like next to them as soon as, you know, we finish a take or I need to communicate something with them or to the DP who's operating the camera as well. Or sometimes, yeah, Yeah, all around there.
Got it. Yeah. Alexander, shoes?
And where Merrill's. Merrill's.
Any
and
reason?
similarly, no Video Village. I'm right next to camera.
Got it. Greta, what shoes do you wear? What's your footwear?
Nike Air Force Ones that are usually, during Barbie, they were pink. I'm cheesy. Sometimes I'm at the monitor, but most often I usually end up underneath the camera looking up. And I sit on an Apple box, which a couple weeks into the shoot, the grip and art department made me my own Apple box with my name on it. And I was like, oh, I'm so glad they like me.
Did they paint it pink?
They painted it pink and they put a cushion on top of it and it said Greta's. And I was like,
Marty, what do you wear?
Oh, well, it goes back a long time. On Mean Streets, I was on Fry Boots. And from Alice Doesn't Live Anymore to Earth Shoes, because I wasn't used to the earth. And then from there on in, it's been trying. And finally, I had some shoes made, suede with white stitching, with a nice sole. But after a while, somebody gave me Nokas or Okas or something.
Okas.
Yeah, and that you really, I don't feel the weight on my knees, in a sense. So I've been using those, actually, because one of the key things you need to be a director is good legs. Seriously, because you're always jumping up. You're always moving around.
In fact,
your knees.
Are you sitting or standing most of the time? Both.
Sitting a lot now, but jumping. A great deal of jumping.
I don't know if we're going to pick up furious jumping. Will
no,
we keep
no,
that going?
No. And I must say, sometimes really utilizing the video as much as possible. In the case of some weather situations, in the case of Killers of the Flower Moon, we were stuck shooting in a very difficult time there. It's a great place to shoot, but it was summer in Oklahoma, and it's 105 to 110 degrees Fahrenheit, and so. I found that I had to be in areas where I could breathe a bit. But it was a problem of jumping from the video back into the set, back to the actors, hanging around the camera. It was a constant.
Let's jump into production design. All five of your films really have very specific worlds that you create. And Marty, in particular, I noticed that some of the interiors, like the pool room, the exteriors were always alive and active.
Yeah.
And can you explain how you set those up, with these builds, and how you made that work?
Adam Sumner, the assistant director, co-producer. You know, these things, I say, okay, look, how it's the director's disease, I guess. It's like, come on, it's a two-shot with the car in the background. Really, let's go. And of course, they have to recreate 1921 with horses and people in costumes. And so I said, let's shoot through the windows. I remember this great shot in Magnificent Ambersons with Ann Baxter and Tim Holt walking along the street. And you don't see the street. The camera's angled towards them with the storefronts. And every reflection, which is real, the reflection is the entire town. All the action's off camera, but it's there. And I said, let's do that. I've always wanted to get that kind of thing. In this case, of course, I love shooting through the windows because so much took place in those storefronts, you know.
And were you building these storefronts?
The storefronts were there in a place called Pawhuska, which is the capital of Osage County. Chief Standing Bear, that's where they operate from. And we created it to look like a place called Fairfax, which is more or less the white European town of in a nearby area. Pawhuska is the main, like the capital. And so many of those storefronts were vacant, and Jack Fisk just literally, we got photographs of what it was like in 1918, 1910, 1920, 1925, and just recreated.
Did you and Jack also build, for example, Molly's house and King's house?
Those two houses were built. He chose the land, and I depended on him greatly because, you know, I'm a New Yorker.
Really?
And I came out and I said, oh, sky, you know, trees. But I mean, it's like, wow, I mean, and so I, it, You know, the funny thing is, in landscape like that, it's where the frame ends and where the frame begins and ends. A city, I kind of know it's grid pattern. I have a sense of buildings, but when you have a beautiful tree here and a hill there, or this, or that, or there. And so I went according to what Jack felt was based upon the actual research of what was there, and we built those houses.
You make, because you move your camera, like moving the camera, for example, through Molly's house, were you already discussing that that's the way I need the interior space so I can go to these five or six rooms with one shot? Or
No, I went the other way, create the house, and then I'll find the way to find... To get through it until we go to the mother's face sitting there.
Got it. And one of the things too was the roofs of the interior roofs.
Oh, the
of
roofs
this
were
house.
The most beautiful. Yeah.
Was that just through research, or where did that?
Just from research, and some of the houses that exist, those panel, those gabled roofs, and they reminded me of German Expressionism or the wonderful gabled roofs in Night of the Hunter, for example. But that bright light too. I was not used to that kind of light.
In terms of the wide shots of the city of Fairfax, what is this all created in reality?
Yes, we did erase some telephone poles in the background, way in the background, and put a few hills in because since the 1921, some buildings or there were other railroad things that have been built, and just to be accurate, you can't really tell. Nobody, if I left it in, you wouldn't know, but just to be accurate.
One more production design, which is the black and white photographs, particularly in the opening, or not photographs, but video films that we're seeing. Some are, I assume, real, like the airplanes, but did you create most of them?
Yes, we created all of them based on 16 millimeter footage that one of the families had, and they gave us. And I have an old camera from 1916 that's hand cranked, that was given to me as a gift years ago. And Rodrigo took the camera, adjusted it, and had Ellen Kouris direct them while I was shooting something else. And we showed the original, got some people, chose the costume, da-da-da, and then literally, did the hand cranking. It was a lot of fun.
Fabulous. Thank you. Greta, you were creating two worlds, the real world, well, maybe the real world, and obviously an incredible fantasy world. As you were getting inspired by imagery for Barbie Land, what were kinds of the images? And I'm looking specifically something like the weird Barbie's house, which has such a specific design to it.
Yes. Well, I always had a concept for what Barbie Land would be, which was kind of almost like a soundstage musical from... the where you could feel the edges of the stage. Like, I mean, I love Vincent Minnelli, and right. I love Brigadoon, or anything with Gene Kelly, basically anywhere where you can feel. I think the thing for me was the idea of a painted sky, that it's authentically artificial, that it's there, but what you're looking at is actually a painted sky that creates the illusion of depth. So. That was sort of where we started from in terms of what I wanted it to feel like. And then because they're toys, it was so important that everything feel tactile. So we did have a lot of stages where we did these big builds, which were unbelievable. And everyone, I mean, like truly the sky painting was made me cry. There are very few occasions that you need a vast, beautiful painted sky. And there's actually a wonderful book about matte paintings and and that is sort of like, it is like these incredible, actually Lemony Snicket, they did incredible paintings and beautiful kind of interior builds that force perspective and stuff like that. And so I wanted that feeling. And then we also had a very large miniatures department to build everything, the whole town and everything in miniature. And some of it we would build both miniature and large so we could photograph both ways, and that you could kind of create this almost a slight catch where you think, I know that's a miniature, But then how are they in it? That it kind of has this...
You did that with the cul-de-sac a couple times?
Yes, we did it with...
You even did that in the opening, because I assume our legs are...
Those legs, we actually did build giant Margot legs. and I remember the man who was a construction manager and everything put them... He had them in his house, and he put them next to his children and sent me pictures, and he was like, is that right? And I was like, what do your kids think you do? But I think, and the miniature department was incredible, and they didn't believe me for a very long time that I actually wanted to build miniatures, and we were shooting in England, and they always say they want miniatures. And they don't. And I was like, no, we want them. And they were like, they finally were making them. It was the most beautiful thing. Anytime I'd get sad, I'd go to the miniatures department and look at them paint palm trees, because it was just emotional.
So talk about Weird Barbie.
So Weird Barbie, yes. Yeah, so we built that. That was both miniature and large scale. So the shot where she's walking up to Weird Barbies, that's just a composite. We would always ask ourselves, how would they do it in the 1950s? Like, how would you do this if, like, we'd give ourselves the restrictions of, like, what would be possible with, like, more basic optical shots, and sort of even, like, with driving shots, like, if it would be rear projection, then you wouldn't move the camera, like, you'd want to pick a frame that you could then use it. So, yeah, she's walking up to Weird Barbie, and that's, it's a composited with a miniature, and then once she's inside, that's a full build.
The actual shape of the house.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that too.
It's the only shapes that don't have completely perfect right angles. We changed the angles, but we had this idea that it was everything in Barbie Land is, I don't know if this is true. In my mind, it was all space trash. Like, meaning, like, if you put like a trash out into space, it never disintegrates. I don't know if that's real, but in my mind, that's how it is. Like, that there wouldn't be actual aging that takes place. It would just be strangely recombined, like a child had done it. And so, you know, and that took many, like anything in films, it takes so many meetings to get to the point where you're like, this is the language of what we're doing. But it was Weird Barbie and Everywhere. It was all these interior worlds. And then unlike creating something real, I wanted that heightened feeling. So I wanted everyone on the stage to be dancers. I wanted everyone that you would see, even when they weren't dancing, to be dancers, because one of the marvelous things I think about musicals is they have this quality of something surreal, because in Oklahoma, if you just look at someone in the background, they're looking at a hat, but it's like their entire body's doing it, and it's strange, but it's like wonderful. And I was like, well, in this language of this movie, I'm gonna have every single person doing something totally odd in the background, and that's the language of dolls, is the language of dancers in a musical.
Thank you. Alexander, I assume most of the film is practical locations.
All of it.
All of it's practical.
Not even a bathroom or a closet, all locations.
And the question, one school, many schools?
Five schools. The Barton Academy, the fictional Barton Academy, is comprised of five different schools in Massachusetts.
And in terms of what became the exteriors versus sort of the interiors, particularly the large auditoriums, which are very powerful because they're oftentimes empty, where did that come from?
Well, you know, film has a wonderful capacity to lie. And so I just thought, well, I like this auditorium, and I like this exterior, and I like this chapel all at different places, and then, you know, they just all meld together in the film.
Now, some things happened in terms of locations and production design accidentally. I'm told that the bowling alley was not in your script, but you were researching and finding. Is this close?
Yeah, correct. I mean, there's a lot of interplay between screenplay and location scouting. So if the screenplay says one thing and we can't find it, or it's going to be too much of a hassle to recreate, then you say, well, I found this location, so let's retool the screenplay. You know, there's a lot of, you know, between casting and screenplay, production design and screenplay, it's a free flow. So the screenwriter had originally written a Winter Carnival, which used to be popular in Boston. I didn't want to recreate a damn Winter Carnival. I've never been to one, you know, Boston Winter Carnival. I don't know, for like a half a page of dialogue. But so in location scouting, we found this candlepin bowling stuff. I said, instead of there, why don't we move it to bowling? Similarly, the screenwriter had the old fantastic pornographic CD Combat Zone of Boston. I don't know, you know, recreate the damn Combat Zone? So anyway, it became an outdoor bookstore, which is actually near the Combat Zone. It was the Combat Zone in Boston, so we could still play that it was on the periphery of that CD area, and an unusual, unsuspected location to be, which is real in Boston, that outdoor bookstore. So stuff like that.
Talking about Boston itself, there is a moment when they walk past, I just have to add, there's a moment when they walk past a graveyard and there's a woman is feeding a squirrel.
Thanks for mentioning that. That's the best shot in the movie.
I love that woman. I love that
That's
squirrel.
The best
like that.
Shot in the movie, Jeremy.
Go on, I want to hear, tell us.
So, well, I'm honored that you asked. Thanks for the interest. So you just have two guys walking through a park, so how can you spice it up a little bit? Well, in Boston Commons, there are all these squirrels, and even in wintertime. So I had an idea, and I looked amid the pool of extras shivering in the, you know, over here, and I pulled out this lady because I liked her costume, and then I said, who's got nuts? And the dolly grip had nuts in his pocket. He always keeps nuts in his pocket. So I gave the lady nuts, and I said, okay, as Paul and Dominic walk by, try to, you know, toss peanuts to that squirrel. Well, eventually the squirrel came close and it took about 11 takes and finally we got it to eat out of her hand in the shot, and that's when I knew we had a movie.
Yeah. One more production. I don't think I'm going to top this one, but the Roxbury House.
The what?
The Roxbury House, where Mary's yes, sister lives.
Right.
It's the three stories, all the rest. Was that, I like that one, we're going to have that, or was that also sort of in the...
It was scripted that her relatives live upstairs somehow, so I told the location people, you know, give me some choices of something where you, with an exterior stairway that's in the right location, suggests the race and class of the people in the screenplay, and we found that place and dressed it.
It's a great location. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Since I know all of your, all of it was practical, you didn't build a thing, just continue. Yeah, continue, it's all practical. Can you start with the
very
boat?
Good locations manager here.
Really? Can you start with the boat and talk about the exterior of the boat and also the interior of the boat? Because they both are so striking, and obviously the interior plays such a big role in terms of the story. But how did that evolve, particularly starting with looking at the boat, and then how do you design the interior?
Yeah, so we also used quite a few miniatures. So all the wide shots of the boat are miniatures, and then we would composite people on them. Then there was quite a large part of it that was built, and we would do like wide shots up to the point, you know, where the boat finished, and we didn't have more money to extend it. But we scanned the miniature that we built, so whatever we had to fill in, it was an actual built thing and painted and, you know, handmade, so it wasn't like a CGI created thing. And then we used the boat was one of the few times that we used, and the miniatures, an LED screen, because us likewise we wanted to use whatever old school technique we could, you know, use. But then I thought that it would be beneficial to also use technology. So, but even again, the seas and the skies that were in the on the LED screen, it was kind of compiled together by different kind of footage from, you know, the clouds were like liquids that, you know, there's this guy Chris Parks in London that shoots all these liquids. So we composited all of these different landscapes, and we would play them on the LED screen.
The shape of that boat is so striking. Do you remember why and how that happened? Did someone just bring you a model, or had you looked at the images, or what?
No, I mean, we had a long process of figuring out the world and designing the world, and we looked at references, you know, from period things to very contemporary things, and we were always trying to find something that felt unique to the world that we were creating, and we weren't so much cautious about being loyal to the period. So the boat is a combination of, you know, old ocean liners and but with contemporary elements, and so it was just like, you know, feeling free to just, you know, combine things and make something that felt, you know.
You've designed in this three cities. You've got Lisbon, you have Paris, and you have London as well, and also Alexandria specifically. Can you talk a little bit about the Alexandria? This is where she sees the people in
the
poverty.
The slum, yeah.
And it's a sort of an amazing, there's a, first of all, that pullback is an amazing shot when you finally go wide, but even the very structure of that one, of Alexandria, yeah. Can you talk about how that evolved?
Yeah, that was the most complicated. The wide shot is a miniature again. So we shot the miniature and then we composited. We built a set, which was the stairs and the interior of the restaurant and the veranda around it. And so we composited that part of the set to the miniature so that we could have Emma and Gerard going down the stairs. And then her POV, the slum, was again another set that we created. Was mainly the big hole with the people and the animals and everything there. And then that again we composited into the miniature. And again, like Alexandria is not really Alexandria. It's just like a little island with these, you know, cable carts that go there, which were actually miniatures as well. And then we just. It was the only few times that we shot, I think I avoided that day, we shot Emma and Gerard on a green screen, which I hate. So I think I just let Haley, our AD, just do that. Like, just tell them to stand in there and we'll compose it to them there. I can't, you know, look at them against the green screen. the rest of it is a miniature.
And a similar question that I was asking Martin in terms of design and moving camera, because both in particularly in Lisbon, there's a lot of motion. She moves through it as well as your camera moving through it. And the design of it, are you seeing the shots that you want? So you're talking to your production designers of this is what I'm going to shoot, or are you talking, let's create this world and I'll find a way to shoot it?
Yeah, the latter, unless you're trying to achieve something very specific, but it's mostly the latter. Like Lisbon was actually a huge set. That's what they tell me, because when I went in, I was like, she has to wander around here. There's like three streets. How are we going to do this? And everybody was like, whoa, this is the biggest set we've ever seen in our lives. I go like, yeah, but it's like three streets. How are we going to do it? It was just like, we built the biggest that we could. And then, you know, we figured out the shots and, you know, like Alexander says, you know, lying around corners and stuff and, you know, changing the background and trying and make it look bigger than it was.
Cool. Thank you. Chris, you built and you also obviously found real locations, even some of the real locations from the time, Oppenheimer's house. But there's a very specific location that I'd like you to expand on, which is, in fact, a lot of the movie evolves from it, which is the interrogation scene where he is, whether he's going to get clearance or not. And I gather this is not a build. This is a small space. Can you talk about why you made that decision, how you worked it?
Sure. So in this whole film that we put together about the atomic bomb, you want to ask about the little porter cabin we shot in, which is fine. I always like the different directions you go in, Jeremy. But it's an old temporary office that was built in a parking lot of the Braun factory, which is now disused. It's used for a lot of commercials. I'm sure a lot of people here filmed it. They have some buildings that were built, you know, sort of temporarily, more or less glorified porter cabins, and they've been there forever, and they're empty and kind of moldering. And the descriptions of the real space in the security hearings, and Lewis Strauss, who's played by Robert Downey Jr., his character was very, very savvy about how to conduct these hearings. And so he did them. The mall in Washington, they had all these temporary buildings built in World War II that stayed there for about another 10 years. And it was very similar to what we found at the Braun factory. And I got Hoyte, Van Hoyte, and my DP, you know, we went there and looked at it in the room. It's about 7 feet wide. It's very, very small. And I said, well, how do you feel about being in here for a couple of weeks with an IMAX camera with 12 actors? And, you know, is that crazy? And the thing I love about working with Hoyte is, and, you know, he completely got it. I'd convinced Ruth de Jong, my designer, who's a fabulous designer, and she sort of got it, because you have to contrast the claustrophobia and the sort of out of the limelight quality of those hearings with the Senate confirmation hearings of Lewis Strauss, which we shot in New Mexico in a much grander place in a state Senate building. Hoyte sort of loved the challenge, and he understood my concern, which is it's very difficult to make things look small on camera. Sort of the opposite problem you're talking about. You build a giant set, it can be very difficult to make it feel, you know, really expansive. But when you really want something to feel small, it's actually quite difficult to do that. You know, most of the spaces architecturally we've grown up watching in films are underbuilt. They're much smaller than the real world. And so lenses and cinematic languages evolved to maximize that. So when you actually want it to be small, it's quite difficult. So we really went for the smallest possible room. And it meant, you know, we would have a Panavision 70mm camera in the corner and I'd be jammed in beneath it. And there was no, I mean, there was no room for anybody in there apart from, you know, the boom guy and Hoyte behind the camera. And that really, I think, helped the actors. It helped the whole claustrophobia of everything. And we didn't touch the place. We didn't clean up the walls. We didn't do anything. Because it's just, you know, real life just has so much texture. It's very difficult to improve on that or recreate that.
In creating Los Alamos itself, and particularly in creating the tower, because the tower plays obviously such a major role in terms of this entire story, what were you going through? Because you were not just showing it from distance, but we're on it, we're experiencing, we're close to it. Talk about the evolution and how you shot the tower. You maybe.
Yeah, I mean, the tower came about. We built it full size. We looked at building it in the real Trinity location, but it's still it's White Sands, New Mexico. It's still a live fire Department of Defense location. So we were able to go there and look at it, but building it there would have been impractical. So Ruth did a very brilliant thing, which is to look at the mountain range and just move, you know, an hour or so up the mountain, the same mountain range, and find private land, a private ranch in the same proximity to the mountains, and then built the tower there. It's a rare instance of where disorganization really helped me, because we hadn't had a meeting about what scale we were going to build the tower, you know, how we were going to go about it. And I think, I hadn't worked with Ruth before, and I think the art department, you know, probably hearing all my bluster about doing things for real over the years, just assumed that I wanted to build it for real. So they had just figured out how to build the thing, you know, its full height on their budget. And I was like, great. You know, they got a subcontractor in who could build a steel tower like that. The original tower was a radio mast that they had repurposed. And so they built it exactly, you know, the way it was. And then very late in the day, in a production meeting, I sort of said to everyone, well, how are we going to shoot in the cabin at the top? Because it's 120 feet in the air. How are you even going to climb up there? How are we going to get a camera up there? And it was just one of those things. You have them on every film where no one had really wrestled with that. And they were talking about 80-foot scissor lifts and things or whatever. And I finally, I'm just like, I'm not going up there. So what? And I said, okay, just build me a second cabin and we'll put it on the back of a truck and we'll just drive it up on the ridge. There's some low hills nearby. And one of the things, I mean, it's an interesting conversation with the visual effects guys always, but a good thing to know is if your camera's at eye height, the horizon is always at eye height. It doesn't matter if you're 1,000 feet in the air, 2,000 feet in the air. And a lot of visual effects people don't understand that. They'll, you know, when you go up, they'll kind of lower the horizon. That's not how nature works. So if you build on the ground, as long as, you know, we had a clear view to the distant scenery, we could just shoot in camera and it was fine. It matched very well what the view was from the tower. So the only person who actually had to climb it other than stunt guys was Killian. So we put him on a wire and, you know, made him go up. But it was a wonderful thing for me to be able to shoot the reality, because they looked at all the reference and the art department had done an incredible job. And Ruth had found things like very late in the day, she explained to me that when they hoisted the gadget and the tower, they put mattresses underneath it in case it fell. And I was like, well, we got to put that in the film. I mean, it's so representative of how insane the whole proposition was and how scrappy, you know, this operation was.
And I know that in this film, you did not use or did not want to use any kind of CGI.
Yeah.
So therefore, when the explosion happens and there's a series of shots, and they evolve and they get more intense, what were some of the devices that allowed you to be able to have not just one major explosion, but so many varieties of visuals for that?
Well, I showed the script. I mean, the first person I ever showed the script to was always Emma Thomas, my producer and my wife, partner, who reads it. I then immediately showed it to Andrew Jackson, who's done the visual effects for me on the last couple of films and has a special effects background. So he knows the analog world as well as the CG world. And I showed it to him very early because I said there are going to be very few shots in the film, but I really want to find a way to do them in an analog way. Because to me, computer graphics, though it's incredibly versatile, you know, the things you could do with CG are amazing, they tend, for me as an audience member, to round off to animation. They tend to feel a little safe, a little distance. And he got that, and he really just, at first on his own, and then with Scott Fisher, our special effects coordinator, he spent months and months and months just coming up with all kinds of different approaches to how they would do this. First, the visualizations of the quantum world that you get in Oppenheimer's mind, and then their ultimate expression in the Trinity test. And the combination was massive explosions out in the desert with different frame rates, forced perspective and so on, with very complex combinations of, you know, magnesium flares along with gasoline, you know, in the right combinations to give the flash at the beginning, and then very, very small miniature work, tiny, you know, things floating in liquids, balloons in liquids, things like that, and then shockwaves. Maybe, you know, Andrew would set up a, you know, a table of dust and have a wire that he would trigger that would, you know, shoot towards camera and use this extremely high frame rate, so you get this kind of shockwave effect. And you combine a lot of these things in camera and then composite a lot of them after the fact.
In camera?
So a lot of them were done in camera. A lot of them were done in camera. I mean, I would say of the Trinity test itself, probably half of those shots are actually just optical blow-ups to IMAX from 35mm VistaVision. He did a remarkable job. And the thing that we never really talked about it because I think it would have been too daunting, but it was in the back of my mind, is I knew we would have no sound on it. Because the truth is, when you do visual effects, to sell visual effects in films, usually the sound is doing an enormous amount of work.
You chose silence.
Well, I didn't feel I had a choice, really, because the reality, you know, you're trying to portray the reality, and they had to be 5 miles away from the ignition. And so you have that period of time you have to deal with, which in cinematic terms is endless. It was about 25 seconds before the sound hit.
That choice, was that a choice that was, if we get to editing, was that a choice that you preconceived, I know I want these visuals, and I know I don't want to hear it?
Yeah, I put it in the script. I mean, I tried to imagine how we would do it, and wound up using a bit of dialogue from earlier in the film where, you know, he famously, this line from the Bhagavad Gita went through his head, you know, I am become death, destroyer of worlds. It made sense, therefore, we had this moment of silence to give it an intimacy and just hear the sounds of breathing and that kind of thing. But I didn't really have a backup plan. I was a little afraid of the whole, I was a little afraid of how that was going to work because I'm very used to synchronizing sound effects with picture. We'd experimented with it in Dunkirk a lot. We tried to respect the reality of the more distant explosion. So in that film, we have a series of explosions along the beach and we start out of sync and then they gradually come into sync as it comes closer, things like that. But we were sort of out on a limb, and so much of it really was about the actors and about their response to it.
Let's go into that subject, which is working with your actors. And I'd like you all five to talk about rehearsal. And I'd like you to talk about rehearsal in two ways. One is in the way of if you did any rehearsal, and I know some of you did, beforehand, and what that process is. And it's so intimate, obviously, because nobody else is really around if you're doing it. So it would really be for us to know what you did, if you did pre-rehearsals on, you know, before actually shooting. And then also on the day of. What's the rehearsal on the day of? You have something to shoot? How do you rehearse at this particular moment? And Mari, I'm going to turn this over to you, if you will. First of all, was there rehearsal time before you actually started shooting? And if so, what did you all do?
Well, it was a confusing situation because, excuse me, I had at first thought, as Eric Roth and I could put a script together in 2017 before doing the film The Irishman. But then De Niro and a number of others pointed out that if we waited a couple of more years for Irishman, no CGI would help.
I got it. Last lines in Greta's movie, I got it.
You know what I mean? We had to go in and do it. And the damn CGI thing, but they turned out beautifully, I think. But it was a whole new world. And in any event, during that process, we were working on the script and working on the script. And then at the during the post-production of Irishman, we got the script up to a certain point at which that and a couple of trips to Oklahoma I made and meeting with the Osage people there, in, especially in a place called Gray Horse, which is another district, I began to realize that the approach we were taking of the script was the opposite of what it should be. Because when I got to Gray Horse, they threw a dinner for us, and I hadn't realized, and it was, they said a few people, it was 250 Osage in regalia, and a traditional dinner. And then people got up and started speaking about, into a mic, speaking about their grandparents' experiences, their uncles, their aunts. And I realized that the, I would say the catastrophe had a face. And the face was, the story was here, particularly Margie Burkhart, Ernest Burkhart's, the character DiCaprio plays, his granddaughter, pointed out, because you must remember, she said, first people were a little apprehensive because of the kind of films that I'm known for in terms of apparently a lot of violence in them. And
it's movies, you know?
Yeah, I didn't make only, not every film, but on the other hand, anyway. But she got it up and pointed out she had seen Silence and knew that there was something else there. And then she said, you have to remember her grandmother and grandfather, they were in love. And that's when it suddenly hit me. I said, I think we're coming at this from the wrong direction. And then COVID hit. And that year, when we were locked off, when we were all locked off, I mean, my wife and I, we couldn't see our daughter. I mean, it was just, I was on a Zoom usually or on phone working on the script. Right before COVID hit, Leo had the same impression and said, maybe instead of playing Tom White, who was played beautifully by Jesse Plemons in the film, I should play Ernest. And I said, because he asked me, where's the heart of the film? I said, the heart is they were in love. And the heart also, I found out, was that, and this is by way of rehearsal I'm talking now, the heart was also the fact that another Osage gentleman who was a lawyer and was pretty much against making the film looked at me and said, you don't understand. He said, Bill Hale and Henry Roan, guy he has shot in the back of the head, they were best friends. I'm saying, what's going on here? There's something else besides villain and the hero. None of that doesn't exist. What exists is complicity and a sense of dehumanization. And so I said, but yet it's all based on love and trust and the betrayal thereof. And when we said, well, yeah, friends could betray you, but a husband and wife having children. So Leo looked at me and said, I think I should play Ernest. And we realized the whole script had to be taken from the center and ripped out and reworked from another angle. And that happened during COVID, basically. And so by the time we were thrown into production, I hadn't finished it. And so we were finishing it, pretty much as we were shooting. And they were rehearsals. I would call them rehearsals. They were meetings, they were discussions. And a lot of it came from the Osage Nation themselves. For example, real quick, a man named Chris, who was teaching, because the language is gone now. There's only a few people who know a little bit of the language. So he was teaching Lily Gladstone how to speak it, and also Ernest Leo DiCaprio's character also spoke Osage because he really liked them. He was teaching them all that, and then he would tell stories, folk tales about a trickster, a coyote in the whirlwind, and she brought that up. Chris Cote just said this, and I said, and she said, what if Leo's the trickster? He's actually a coyote in the whirlwind. She's the whirlwind, and she wins ultimately. It's very much of a prominent figure, like De Niro was the raccoon. The prominent figures in the folktales, like all these things fed into the shoot. But because we had, I felt control over the location, because the little town itself became like a back lot. I knew that we could move from one place to the other if we want to rewrite something and shoot another day. You follow? And so the weather didn't matter except for the heat. And nobody could read that on screen anyway. And the tornadoes, which we were lucky. But what was happening was that as each day went by, because a lot of what we were learning from the Osage themselves, and we became very friendly with them, and I don't know, we had a good time together. We were just hanging out all the time on set. They were behind the camera, in front of the camera. And so the scripting came from myself and rehearsals, which actually were readings of the scenes, and then saying, what if we do this? What if we change that? And the key element was ultimately, how much did Ernest know and when did he know it? Was he really, really that delusional to think he wasn't hurting her? And she really, really trusted him to the very end. And she did. In reality, even the FBI guys were saying when she was in the courtroom, she would go every day to the courtroom. The FBI guys would say, she's here again. When is she going to realize?
Love is blind.
Yeah. What is that? And then finally, afterwards, she left him.
When you would walk onto the set, let's say, doing a scene, I'm looking at a long dialogue scene between when King and Ernest meet for the first time. This is a long dialogue.
Well, that was written many different times, and then I combined it from different scenes.
And what would you do, though, if that's the scene you're shooting today? What's the rehearsal bar? Do you actually get your actors? Did you get them together and rehearse this scene before
I tried
your
to.
Crew?
I tried to. Bob had hurt his leg, his knee gave out, and so a lot of the scenes he's in, De Niro, are now seated. But it was fine, he had his leg up, you know, nobody had. And I was thinking, do we have to shoot him falling off a horse? I said, no, it doesn't matter. He's an older man, he sits with, anyway. it was nice. So we combined different versions of the script that I had, of that scene that I had for quite a while. And basically we got together and made sure it was going. We all made sure where it was going. Like, no, we took that line and put it here. Oh, no, but what if I do? Literally, that's all it was. And they were seated. There couldn't be too much damage in terms of movement.
Now, when you're doing this, and where's the crew? Is there
I don't know. They were in the house somewhere. But the thing I have it, I have a thing with noise. I just don't want anybody around me making any, you know, banging on and that sort of thing. I just can't do it.
Right.
I have a bad, they give me headaches. So everybody knows now to be respectfully quiet for the actors, so the actors could concentrate. And then I could even concentrate with Rodrigo and say, you know what, where the hell are we aiming? What about that lamp over there? What about, you know, this sort of thing? And the movement goes from left to right, not right to left. And so they're very respectful over the years, I get that. They wait, actually.
In another one where he's saying the argument about I'm gonna give her a shot on medicine, and you know, he attacks her. This is when he gets—
Oh, he did that in Osage.
Got it.
Yeah.
So, but my curiosity also is sort of, you're rehearsing that scene before you're shooting it. What is that process? Again, is it similar?
That again was everybody out.
Right.
Two of us, leave us alone for a couple of hours. Leave us alone for a couple of hours, man. Just don't, please. And the minute, we got the angles, we know. And once they get to two or three, maybe four times, we got it, you know. And are we coming in tighter? Not necessarily, this way, that way. And the fact that it's an Osage, it worked many different ways. For example, becoming so close with the Osage, there was a scene in a roundhouse where there's a, Yancey Redcorn, who plays Chief Bonnycastle, is saying, you know, two people have been found dead this week from the Osage, specifically dead, shot, you know, which means that they didn't die of the weakness, illness, whatever it is. They couldn't fudge it, like with bad alcohol or whatever. These people were shot. And so he called everyone together and they're talking. And the set was really nice that Jack had built based on the real roundhouse. But you know, it was hot. It was real hot. And there was Yancey Redcorn and a man named Everett Waller, very big Osage guy and formidable. You know, first when I met him, hi. This guy is like, how you doing? And he would look at me, you know. And he had a way of speaking. He was also a lawyer. Right. And he was sitting next to Yancey. And at one point, real fast, I got him because he goes, I said, I need a reaction shot of some of the Osage that are here to some of the down lines that Yancey's been saying. So I knew Everett could push it a little bit. I said, Everett, would you mind doing some off camera for me? But I'm just going to go check the angles of the, you know, for the reaction shot. Some people, I keep thinking, you know, widescreen. I want that Eisenstein 133 look, but you can't get it in 235. So I run out and I go into where the video is and it's hot. And I'm doing, I'm looking and I hear noise. And De Niro comes running out. He goes, Marty, come back. Watch this. And I went in and Everett was, you know, he was going and the people were reacting. And we stopped it, and I said, can you do that again sitting down? He goes, it's your world. I said, sit down, man, two cameras on this bastard. And that was it, and he went off. So what you see in the film is when he's speaking about how we came out of Missouri and we rode our horses over our dead babies. Nobody's gonna take us from this land unless they kill us. And then ending with, you know, we never asked for the good life or the great life, we just asked for life.
Right.
That's the movie, I said. That was the movie,
right
there. And I don't know whether it was narrative or whether it was what you would call a documentary, where we always talk about that unfair separation.
Yeah.
What happens there? That's real.
Thank you, Marty. It's powerful stuff. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to part one of this exclusive discussion. You can watch the full video of the Theatrical Feature Film Symposium on our website at dga.org/events. And stay tuned for the next episode, where our five theatrical feature film nominees will conclude their conversation. Past episodes of The Director's Cut are available wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget to share, subscribe, rate, and review. We'd love to hear your feedback, and you can help fellow film buffs find the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is produced by the Directors Guild of America